From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The world has changed and changed again since 1960, when President Eisenhower imposed the first U.S. sanctions on Cuba. Through all those years, the United States has held firm on its embargo on the communist neighbor just south of Florida. Raul and Fidel Castro may be on their last legs now, but the embargo rolls on. Should it? Does it still make sense? This hour on Point, Cuba and the United States, and a new call to reconsider the American embargo to find another way with Cuba. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you say? Embargo to the bitter end or let it go? Cuban Americans, is it time for a fresh conversation here or not? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's one American politician, Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, who says no to taking off the embargo. He spoke on the Senate floor about the oppression in his parents' native Cuba.
Let me tell you what the Cubans are really good at. They don't know how to run their economy. They don't know how to build a country. They don't know how to govern a people. What they are really good at is repression. What they are really good at is shutting off information to the internet and to radio and television and social media. That's what they're really good at. And they're not just good at it domestically. They're good exporters of these things.
Yes, and we know, we've heard for a long time, but not everybody's on board anymore. Here's former Florida Republican Governor Charlie Crist, now running for election as a Democrat, telling HBO's Bill Maher he now opposes the embargo on Cuba.
And the embargo's been there, what, 50 years now?
Right.
I don't think it worked. It is obvious to me that we need to move forward, and I think get the embargo taken away.
We're going to dive in on all angles. Joining me first today from New York is Ernesto Londoño. He writes on foreign affairs as a member of the New York Times editorial board, and he helped shape Sunday's Times editorial headlined, Obama Should End the Embargo on Cuba. You'll find a link to that editorial at our website, onpointradio.org. Ernesto Londoño, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What's the heart of the argument that you and your colleagues make in the Times?
Well, I think we felt it was a good time to take a hard look at Cuba policy. There's going to be a summit next year in Panama City where leaders from the region will come together. And for the first time, Latin American leaders have insisted that Cuba be at the table. In the past, the United States has said that Cuba, because it's not a democracy, doesn't belong a seat at the table, and the U.S. has been successful at blocking Cuba. This year, the region essentially said Cuba is coming, whether you like it or not. So what this means is it'll be an opportunity, presumably, for President Obama and Raul Castro for the first time to be at a diplomatic summit together. And this poses a series of awkward and difficult questions for the administration. How to engage with Cuba, whether to engage with Cuba, how big of a stink to make about the fact that they're there. And we felt that it was time for an ambitious change. We felt that the administration at this time could really take a hard look at its Cuba policy and could take steps toward restoring diplomatic relations as a first step, and then looking at ways to loosen the embargo and essentially do away with the embargo. We felt that if this is done successfully, and it is by no means risk-free, it represents the best opportunity for the U.S. to empower Cuban people and to lay the groundwork for change that we think would be healthy and in the interest of both the Cuban population and in bilateral ties down the road.
I want to look at all those points, but let's go first to, I mean, the original intention of the embargo, and certainly as it evolved, was to push Cuba toward granting more freedoms to its citizens. Many would say that has not happened, and so why let up?
Well, I think the embargo for a long time has had the intent of trying to drive the government out of power, to try to suck the oxygen out of the Cuban government's room and make it untenable for them to govern. They've weathered, you know, pretty severe storms over the years. They've weathered, you know, very, very bad economic times. They've weathered political turmoil. They've sort of stuck to their way of governing, even as the region changed considerably, even as other leftist movements in the region had to change, had to adapt, and sort of went away. So we don't really feel that Cuba is on the brink of the Castro regime is on the brink of being washed out. And in fact, we see them taking steps to engage with other members of the international community. They're expanding trade with the European Union. They've been in closer consultations with the Chinese, with the Russians. They are looking for ways to diversify their economy, to bring in other global players. You know, if the U.S. continues to impose the embargo and continues to be an outlier, all we're going to do is sit on the fence and have very limited ability to control what the post-Castro Cuba is going to look like.
When you talk about post-Castro Cuba, then, you're not anticipating, as I hear you, Ernesto, a change in Cuban politics, the Cuban system. So would dropping the embargo be the U.S. saying, all right, never mind, we get it. You're socialist, communist, you're 90 miles across the straits here, but that's all right by us. Would that essentially be the message?
No, I don't think this could or should in any way be interpreted as a reward for the Cuban government, which we think has a dismal record on pretty much any significant metric that you look at. However, you look at the Castro brothers, who have been sort of the face and the heart of the regime, and they're both elderly. They're not going to be around for many, many years. So the two of them, presumably, are trying to lay the groundwork for a succession plan that they think is sound. What that succession will eventually look like, nobody knows. But I think if we choose to engage and if we find ways to expand dialogue, expand trade, expand contact between Americans, American entrepreneurs, the Cuban diaspora, and ordinary Cubans, Cubans who are in the process of trying to set up businesses, Cubans who are in the process of trying to expand their education, to learn more about the world. I think you stand to empower Cubans from the ground up and to give them a greater voice and a greater say in what their country will ultimately look like and what the government in Cuba must ultimately look like.
Lots of other countries trade with Cuba, travel freely to Cuba, invest in Cuba. Opponents to the U.S. dropping the embargo say that the profits from many of those foreign investments and engagements in Cuba don't go to the Cuban people. They go to the ruling elite. And therefore, the more of that investment you have, the more power you give to the very folks who are not empowering the grassroots, as you say.
Absolutely. That's a worthwhile argument. If we were to expand ties with Cuba, if we were to start creating mechanisms to pour more capital into the island, you certainly could see a scenario where you start helping out the regime, where you start giving them some more tools to stay in power. However, I think we should try to devise this in a way that limits that tries to find ways to keep our engagement and our funds and our dialogue not centered at the government level, not done in a way that props them up or gives them a better standing or more legitimacy, but in a way that empowers ordinary Cubans and in a way that helps Cubans speak out against their government, criticize their government, spark a healthy debate about what the government should look like. And I think there's a way to do it. I don't think it'll be perfect. I don't think anybody thinks this will be easy. I don't think anybody thinks this would be risk-free. But if you look at the past 5 decades, what we've done has not worked. The government is still in place. It's still entrenched. The island continues to be poor. People continue to be repressed. And I don't think the formula you have in place has really any hope of starting to pay dividends in the years ahead if we stick to the policy we have.
You've mentioned,
so what we're arguing is let's try something radically new.
You've mentioned risks a couple of times, Ernesto. What risks do you see potentially attendant to the U.S. dropping its embargo on Cuba?
You know, I think certainly if we restore diplomatic relations with Cuba, we elevate their standing on the global stage. And, you know, they might find ways to take advantage of that. They might find ways of portraying that as a reward, as a recognition of their legitimacy. And, you know, I think that would be troubling. I would try to find ways to engage with them, but make clear that we reject and vehemently disagree with the way they've governed, with the way they've treated dissidents, with their approach to the press, their approach to people's rights to voice their opinions and their grievances. So I think, I mean, that's one major risk. Mm-hmm. The other major risk is if you start injecting capital, to what extent do you start giving the government more tools and more power to stay to stay in place. And, you know, I think we would have to be creative about how we do that. We would have to be creative about how we try to ensure that the bulk of the capital and the bulk of our engagement is at the grassroots level.
The thrust of your editorial in The Times, which you've had a hand in, does not go to reversing the American law, standing law here. Rather, it seems to appeal to President Obama to take steps through executive action. Why not go to the law itself, which is the base of the U.S. embargo? Do you feel you wouldn't, or there wouldn't be, the political support to do what you're calling for?
Well, the editorial does address the fact that sort of an outright and complete repeal of the embargo will ultimately take congressional action. It's not clear to me that you really have support for that at the moment. There's still, I think, a very influential and very vocal segment on the Hill that opposes this for valid reasons, and that would, you know, that would fight very, very hard for any movement on the Hill for this. However, we think if the president were to start taking unilateral action that he can take just through executive power, he could really spark a debate and change the political climate enough so that it would be palatable for Congress to tackle this eventually.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Cuba and whether it's time for the United States to lift its nearly 54-year-old embargo on its Cold War adversary. Ernesto Londoño is with us. He writes on foreign affairs as a member of the New York Times editorial board. Their editorial on Sunday, Obama should end the embargo on Cuba. We'll hear voices on either side of that question in just a moment, but there is a lot of history here, of course. October 1962, President John F. Kennedy appearing on TV to inform the nation about what he said, the discovery of Soviet nuclear missile installations in Cuba, and to announce a naval blockade.
This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
Scary. It was scary, but it was 1962. On the other hand, right now, you've still got voices in Congress, some very prominent, saying no change, no way. Here's chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Republican Representative Ileana Ross Leighton of Florida, a vocal opponent of lifting the Cuban embargo, the first Latina elected to Congress, the daughter of Cuban-American political refugees. She told Local 10 News in Miami earlier this year that the U.S. needs to maintain solidarity with her community.
If you ask people in our community, are they for holding back on investment in Cuba until we have freedom, respect for human rights, yeah, multi-party elections, freedom press of assembly, and free press, people would say yes. You know, we had international solidarity against a terrible apartheid government in South Africa.
Right.
We lack that in Cuba. I realize that, and it would be better to have multilateral sanctions. But doing the right thing is the right thing to do, even if you have to do it alone.
Is Cuba changing? Well, Fidel Castro stepped down in 2008, handed the reins to his brother Raul. Last year, Raul Castro made a speech announcing that he will be stepping down from the Cuban presidency in 2018. He's in his 80s. He said he hopes to establish term limits and age caps for political offices to make way for a younger generation of Cuban leadership, but change not so clear.
This decision shows a particular historic transcendence because it represents a definite step toward the configuration of the nation's future leadership through the gradual and organized transfer of key roles to new generations.
New generation, maybe an old and familiar system. Ernesto Londoño joins us from New York in the New York Times. With us now from Washington is Jorge Benitez, senior fellow in the Brent Snowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council. He was born in Cuba, came to the U.S. when he was 7, contributed to the New York Times Room for Debate series that had a lot of people talking recently, saying the U.S. should hold firm on sanctions. Jorge Benitez, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
And from the studios of WLRN in Miami, we're joined by Rick Herrero. He's the son of Cuban exiles, born in Puerto Rico, executive director of Cuba Now, an advocacy group calling for a new conversation in the U.S. about Cuba. He also contributed to the Times Room for Debate segment. Rick Herrero, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me, Tom.
Rick, I'll give it first to you, then we'll go to Jorge. The core of your argument for a new conversation, and by that, do you mean drop the embargo?
No. We actually think that this rhetoric of either lifting the embargo unilaterally or let's not touch the embargo until there is a democracy in Cuba is part of what has kept us stuck in the stalemate for 50 years. It's an all-or-nothing frame that has only helped to keep those who most benefit from the status quo not only here but also in Cuba, because they only talk about lifting the embargo over there and use it as their most effective propaganda tool to excuse their ongoing human rights abuses and their many economic failures. It only benefits these folks, the folks, the entrenched interests on both sides. There haven't been enough people in this debate, however, that feel like a majority of Cuban Americans feel today, that both the Cuba's government has been a repressive regime and that it has systematically violated human rights of its citizens. However, that our policy response to this reality has been a dismal failure and must be reformed. And that's what we're advocating for. We're not calling for a wholesale lifting or keeping. We're calling for a third approach, one that's hard on the government but soft on the people, to help empower that people so that they can be in a better position to demand more changes from their government and, you know, become the authors of their own future.
Would part of that change be loosening of the embargo? And if so, what? What loosening?
Well, let's think about what the embargo is to begin with, right? Mm-hmm. The embargo is a collection of sanctions and restrictions that were put in place mostly 50 years ago and were codified into law in the 90s under the Cuba Democracy Act and much more strongly under Helms-Burton. And then the lifting of all these sanctions, it's an all-or-nothing proposition, is conditioned upon a series of steps that the Cubans have to take that basically amount to them abdicating power. The Castro's being out of office, having multi-party elections, freedom of all political prisoners, freedom of assembly, freedom of press, so on, which are all great things that we would love to see in Cuba. But this policy doesn't get us there. All this policy has actually succeeded in doing is letting the Cubans set the timeline for that. Because if they're saying, well, if we don't have to deal with the Americans until we do all these things, then thank you. You guys can stay out of our hair. We're going to continue ruling the way we want to. And then when we're good and ready to let you guys back in, we'll do so.
So what would you loosen and where? What policy? Where would you change?
Look, travel is, you know, we've seen with the changes in 2009, the travel and remittance changes that President Obama implemented, we've seen that they have had a more positive impact inside the island than 50 years of Cold War policy had before them. You're seeing that by having this increased access to contacts and to capital from outside, you're seeing a more diversified civil society, a more numerous and active and vocal internal opposition, and over 470,000 licensed independent entrepreneurs who are starting their businesses, in many cases, with seed capital from folks back in Miami. This is creating a whole new sector within Cuba of people who are increasing their independence from the state, who no longer depend on the state to meet their most basic needs, and who are increasingly in a better position to demand more changes from that state. We should be doing everything, any policy, any sanction that neither influences the regime, neither helps the people, nor advances the interests of the United States needs to be reviewed and lifted. So anything that helps us open up to the people and help empower that civil society, we think is a good thing. There are other sanctions, however, that do make sense. For example, not providing federally backed credits to the Cuban-run enterprises until they can show that they are credit worthy. That makes sense. We're not opposed to that.
I want to look at how much further you'd go on that front. Jorge Benitez, please join us here. The New York Times says end the embargo. Rick Herrero says change the conversation. It sounds like he's pro-loosening. Where do you come down now, Mr. Benitez, after all these years? How do you see the situation?
I think Ernesto and Rick both have very admirable ambitions and aspirations for the Cuban people. But unfortunately, their analysis is sort of driven by a world of what Cuba could be and what Cuba might be, perhaps even what Cuba should be. But unfortunately, I think we have to deal with the Cuba that we have and the Cuban government in Havana that, as all of us agree, is oppressing its people, has tremendous human rights abuses. And the question is, how do we more quickly remove this government from power? And the logic that we can provide them with rewards and incentives to change, the facts on the ground just proven that that hasn't worked. For over two decades now, the rest of the world has been trading with Cuba and providing this kind of external influence. But the problem is the Castro regime only allows this to happen on its terms. So the fact that you have Rick talked about tourism and the many people that are traveling to Cuba. So we've had over 15 million tourists travel to Cuba, but it has not produced any more democratic change in Cuba. And the few people that are, what Rick said, calling for change in Cuba, those people are oppressed and stepped down hard by the government. Already this year, we've seen over 7,000 political arrests in Cuba. So the change is all the positive things are controlled by the government, so it only brings in money for them. And when the Cubans talk about liberalizing the economy or liberalizing trade, what they really mean is providing more opportunities for foreign investment to come in and pour money into the government. And let's be clear about one thing. It's not a question of some of the money or even most of the money going to the government. All of the money has to go to the government. It's in the Cuban Constitution. The state owns all of the resources in Cuba. And the Cuban government then pays the wages to the people in Cuban dollars. So it dilutes in the Cuban currency exchange, and it keeps most of the profits for itself.
Let me ask you, Mr. Benitez, many of our listeners, they're all over on this issue, but a lot are pointing out, they say, look, the United States does all kinds of trade with communist China. We do all kinds of trade with Russia. On a vast, vast scale in both those cases, especially China. And they're pointing that out as an inconsistency here. We're trading like crazy with China. We don't with little Cuba. What about the inconsistency listeners are pointing to?
Well, there's some major differences in that. On the one hand, the trade that we have with those other countries, there's always been some opposition to them because there's been some concerns that we in some ways legitimizing their continued control and oppression of
their
people.
But we're doing it by the billions, even trillions.
But the question is, do three wrongs make a right, Tom? But the even more important argument is they are qualitatively different from the Cuban case. Because in the Russian case, the Russian government isn't as controlling as Havana is. Beijing isn't as controlling as Havana is. They're actually allowing some of this trade to go to the people. And you're seeing a growing middle class in China that after two decades, 20 years of trade with 99% of the world, you have not seen that in Cuba.
Tell that to the kids in Hong Kong, though, who just got totally ignored and put down in their call for just a little bit of democracy where they have some guarantee of it. I mean, Beijing hardly looks like a paragon of democracy in any way.
Well, thank you for raising that because that's exactly my point. We have sacrificed their political freedom for some degree of economic benefits and liberalization. And that raises a great question of even that could work in Cuba. And my example was we're not even at the China point in Cuba yet. So why do we want to go down that road with Havana?
Let me get a call from Greg in Waverly, Iowa. Greg, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Fantastic show. Great subject. I've been to Cuba a couple of times, and what I've seen when I've been there is that foreign currency and the U.S. dollar are the greatest agents for change there. The last speaker said that it's all controlled by the government, and I agree that the government is being very careful about how they open up their markets, but they are opening up their markets. And in fact, there are some semi-private enterprises there, like Paladars, which are family restaurants, and also private taxi drivers. So the sanctions, in that way, they get in their own way. They kind of stumble upon themselves because they do provide a fantastic excuse, and also the people know that those sanctions are coming from the state and that social benefits are coming from the government. I'm not saying Cuba is a perfect place, not by any means, but no country is.
Greg, we've got it. Greg's been there. He's seen the effect of foreign currency on society, thinks more of it would be good. We'll look at that. Ernesto Londoño, how do you see the effects already I mean, after all, much of the world trades openly with Cuba. Lots of tourists go there from all over the place. As Jorge Benitez says, maybe 15 million. How do you see the effects of that in terms of bolstering a more empowered civil society? Jorge Benitez says it's just not enough. Rick Herrero says, and our caller Greg say, that is over time loosening up Cuba. How do you see it, Ernesto?
I think it's important to take stock of the steps the Cuban government has taken in recent years. And there's been backsliding. They've been inconsistent. It's been sometimes two steps forward, three steps back. But there have been very significant changes. For starters, the Cuban government started allowing Cubans to work in the private sector. That was a huge sea change. It hasn't been, completely widespread. It hasn't been perfect. But you are starting to see the emergence of a private sector. And that, I think, changes things dramatically. On the other hand, one element that is very important to take a look at is Cuba historically has been dependent on Venezuela for subsidized oil, mm-hmm. which is
a key
piece of its economy.
Mm-hmm.
Venezuela has very, very challenging financial situation right now. And Cuba and many in the Caribbean that have been recipients of subsidized oil have become very, very nervous about the prospect that there might come a day when they won't get that benefit anymore.
How does this pertain to this question of the embargo, Ernesto?
Well, I think it makes the Cubans recognize that they have to take pretty serious they have to make pretty serious decisions about what their economy is going to look like. And I think it has made them face the fact that they have to prepare for a post-embargo era, that they have to set the stage for an era where they're going to be able to bury the hatchet with the U.S. and operate differently. And I think there's an argument to be made that that's the reason you're starting to see a little bit of an opening in the economy and a little more tolerance for dissent. For example, you have an independent news organization that has been able to set up shop and publish very critical pieces online. The government has been apprehensive about them. They blocked their website for a while. But for the time being, they're able to operate out of Havana and run a pretty, subversive operation. I think that's all worth noting. And I think if you look at all these pieces collectively, they give the unmistakable impression that the Cubans very much recognize and are stealing for a post-embargo era.
Jorge Benitez, do you see elements emerging of a post-embargo era that would be more open, more free, more empowering to ordinary Cubans?
I see very little evidence of that, unfortunately. I wish what Ernesto is saying was more true, but unfortunately, these anecdotal evidence is just – they're very limited. While the Cuban government allows some of these individual cases to kind of showcase its liberalization, when we look at the statistics, when we look at the data, we see that overall the human rights and the oppression is continuing and even getting worse. As I pointed out before, there have been over 7,000 political arrests this year alone, and the year's not even over. That's more than three times as many political arrests as we saw in 2010. So in some cases, the situation is getting worse, not better. And that's, if we look at the overall picture, just not a few limited instances.
But when do you say 50 years has to be enough? 54 years nearly. I mean, can you possibly look at that and say it's effective, Mr. Benitez?
I think it can be effective. The problem is what is propping up the Castro government is external aid. During the Cold War, it was external aid from the Soviet Union. And since the Cold War, it's been external trade and billions of investment from the rest of the world.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour about Cuba and whether it is time for the United States to lift its 54-year-old embargo on its old Cold War adversary. 90 miles from the USA, Cuba, Havana, the regime of Fidel Castro, his brother Raul now. This standoff has gone on a very long time. Attitudes are changing in some quarters, not in others. American politics may still have a no lock on any embargo change here. But that's exactly what we're looking at this hour. How do you see the ideal U.S.-Cuba relationship? With Ernesto Londoño from the New York Times editorial board, Jorge Benitez, he's senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council. Rick Herrero joins us from Miami. He is executive director of Cuba Now, an advocacy group calling for a new conversation in the Cuban-American community on relations with Cuba. And we have a lot of callers for you guys. Jackie in Austin, Texas. Jackie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hello, what do you think?
Well, I think that a lot of people are not aware that the Cuban exile community has been supporting the Cuban people financially for 50 years, and that money unfortunately also gets into the pocket of the government. To consider lifting sanctions on such an oppressive government is ludicrous, and it's shocking that anybody would suggest that the president should, by executive order, lift the Cuban embargo. It is not what this country stands for. We stand for freedom, and we shouldn't be trading with a communist regime 90 miles off of our shores.
But Jackie, I hear what you're saying, but a lot of countries are trading with Cuba. It's been a long time, and this policy hasn't worked. If freer Cuba, significantly freer, is what you want, is there a point at which you say, well, nobody else is doing it, and it's not working, so forget it?
Absolutely not. You know, this president is very involved with creating coalition governments in many other situations. Why doesn't he build a coalition to stop trading with a country like Cuba? Do we trade with the North Koreans? Do you think the Cuban government is less oppressive than the North Korean government? Or are we going to lift sanctions on North Korea? What's next?
Well, I take your point on North Korea, though we trade with China and many others. We've lifted the embargo on Burma, Myanmar. But point taken, Jackie. Let me get one more right here from Miami. Scott is calling. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for talking about this really important issue. I have a comment. I'm a second-generation Cuban-American. My mother was born in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to briefly talk about why my opinion on the embargo differs from my mother and my grandparents. My
yes,
mother
please.
And my grandparents are very much opposed to the Cuban embargo. My grandmother, in fact, when she looks at pictures of her hometown, Santa Clara, she will tell you that...
Oh, Scott, we want to hear that. Are you there? Oh, we lost you, Scott. A generational divide in Scott's family. Let me pick that up. Rick Herrero, you're talking with a lot of people. Do you see a generational divide among Cuban Americans on support or opposition to the embargo, Rick?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a generational divide. It's also a divide among migratory waves, those that came before and those that have come in more recent years. And I think it's, for a lot of folks my age particularly, I'm 36 years old,
mm-hmm.
we've lived our entire life under this policy and have yet to see it yield any result whatsoever. Yet we do see openness in pretty much every other area of the world, how having diplomatic relations, how supporting civil society and helping individuals become empowered in a country does lead to better conditions in that country. So for us, it's a policy that I think, you know, it was put in place with noble intentions. There was a lot of folks who supported it, particularly when it was codified in the 1990s, because they wanted to help try to propel change in Cuba. But it hasn't worked. And that's just something we need to accept. I understand and I sympathize with many of the positions or all the analysis about how repressive this government is. But what is our strategy to change that? Our current strategy doesn't work. We say we don't want to reward them, but how is opening up to Cuban families? How is helping young and this growing entrepreneurial sector in Cuba, how is that in any way a concession to the regime that's trying to oppress them? It's a position that I don't understand.
Jorge Benitez says if you open up and more capital flows in, it will flow to that regime and that will empower them.
Well, Jorge Benitez says that. And I mean, look, it's the way the system is designed, right? I mean, it's a tyrannical system. The money comes in, it goes to their coffers. But the question here is not whether money goes in or not. It's how does it go to the people first? And how does it touch that individual? Does that help? Does it help that individual become more empowered? Does that help that individual start their own small business to increase their own personal autonomy, to decrease their dependence on the state? If it does, then I think it's the same. It's the sort of money that we should be sending down there in droves.
Let's get a call from Toronto, Canada. Ivan's calling. Hi, Ivan. You're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom. There's no doubt that we're dealing with a repressive regime. However, I've been to Cuba several times, and I was listening to the vilification and the demonization of the Cuban government. However, one should see it from the Cubans' point of view. If you take a look at the literacy rate or level in Cuba. It's the highest in Latin America. And they also have a world-class medical system.
True.
Which Canadians go down to Cuba to be treated for all kinds of neurological disorders. So it's not as bad, old, nasty as we think it is. However, if we continue to demonize the Cubans, the Cuban people, they see things not only in black and white like we do from our perspective. They do see some benefits from the Cuban regime, and that has to be acknowledged.
I mean, we see it's true about literacy. It's true they are said to have a very strong health system. I mean, we're reading just in the last few weeks about how Cuba, smallest among the many nations perhaps helping in West Africa, kind of Cuban doctors leading the way on addressing Ebola. But how does that go to the issue of personal freedoms, Ivan? And should we focus there first? Oh, I think Ivan's gone. We'll get one more to follow up on Ivan. Matt in Atlanta. Matt, you're on.
Hi, Tom. How's it going?
Okay. What do you see?
I think that we should drop the embargo. I think that ultimately the embargo only hurts the citizens of Cuba. I mean, look, the Castro brothers are going to continue to drive Mercedes and smoke fine cigars as long as the embargo is in place. I don't think it does any good for the citizens of Cuba. In addition to that, you played a clip at the beginning of the show of a U.S. congressman, I believe it was, saying that Cuba is good at censoring media and has a poor record on human rights. I find it extremely hypocritical of the U.S. government to take a stance that we are going to condemn Cuba on censoring media when most of the mainstream media corporations in America are owned by large corporations pushing similar agendas. And in addition to that, if you want to talk about human rights, with the passage of the NDAA bill a couple of years ago by President Obama, it gives the president the right to imprison U.S. citizens without trial. And so I find it to be a particularly hypocritical stance of the U.S. government to condemn Cuba on that basis.
Don't throw stones, you're saying, Matt, and it's high time to let it go. I appreciate your call as well. Rick, I wanted to ask you, I mean, we saw these headlines recently about the numbers of Cuban immigrants coming to the United States very much up again, including illegal immigration. I mean, I guess there's a lot of legal here, but people coming in by air transport, but also people fleeing across that 90-mile strait again on very rickety boats and all the rest. Why is that happening, Rick?
Because their economic system is a disaster, plain and simple. But the question should be, what should our response be? We here in the United States, should we just keep yelling that, oh, this is a tyrannical government and we shouldn't do anything until they stop being tyrannical? Or see how we can do what we can do to help improve the situation in the island to some degree. And I don't think that by clamping down on the flow of contacts and resources to the Cuban people, you're helping that. If anything, you're incentivizing more people to risk their life by taking to the high seas, because it becomes even harder for more Cubans to get by inside the island.
Jorge, you know, lots of Cubans who came in earlier waves had suffered losses to Castro and the communist revolution in Cuba. Deep bitterness about that. Do you see a generational change, Jorge? Will younger Cubans say, we understand, but we tried that, as Rick says, for half a century plus, and it hasn't worked. Let's do something different.
There are some incremental generational changes because, as Rick said, some of the most recent waves of immigrants from Cuba grew up under the Castro regime. So they've been living for years, for all of their lives, under the propaganda that Havana has been telling them of what is wrong with the United States and what is great about Cuba. But yet the reality is they still chose that things were so bad under Castro to come to the United States. But there's still that residual misinformation in their minds. So they have some concerns about the U.S. sanctions. And also, as the younger people, let's face it, over the last three presidential administrations, there hasn't been that much attention to Latin America. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the communities in Florida and across the United States, they're just not as informed about Cuba and what's actually taking place there.
Yes, and I wanted to ask you as well about Rick Herrero's point. He says, look, even if lifting the embargo is imperfect, it will over time have the effect of empowering ordinary Cubans, simply because there'll be more business, more capital around, more opportunities for engagement with people from outside Cuba, that it will inevitably, he suggests, Jorge, lead to more freedom in Cuba. What do you say to that?
That's still an analysis based on what might happen, what he wishes would happen. But I'm basing my analysis on what has happened now after 20 years of trade and tourism and travel with millions of people from Canada, from democracies like France and Britain and Spain and Mexico going to Cuba. Have we seen any of this empowerment of the people for 20 years now? Has trade and aid with the Castro government brought any liberalization or political space for the Cuban people?
I'd like to respond to all this. For starters, the point about Cubans coming here and somehow having still be confused because of all the propaganda they were fed while they were on the island, I think I find that pretty condescending. It's these people suffered under that system. They understand it better than anyone else. Mm-hmm. They also understand better than anyone else how our policy has done nothing to improve the condition for the average Cuban in the island. So that's why they don't support it, because they also see how it hurts their families. That's the reason why they don't, by and large, support this policy. And then I also want to address the point about Cuba doing trade with the rest of the world, and that haven't had a significant change, provoked a significant change. Listen, between the U.S. and Cuba, the problem is a political one. Whenever Cuba has some sort of financial crisis, they don't blame it on Peru. Whenever they have to crack down on dissidents, they don't blame it on England. It's all blamed on the United States. It's their chief and most reliable propaganda tool to secure international sympathy for their epic struggle against the tyrant of the North, as they like to call it, and to excuse all their economic economic failures and human rights abuses.
Tom in Boston. Tom, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I visited Cuba with my son, Nick, and speaking with taxi drivers, cigar sellers, just numerous people, all of them unanimously said, the second the U.S. lifts its embargo on Cuba, the regime falls. There would just be all the things that one of your guests has mentioned in terms of the empowerment of people in Cuba as a result would just lead to an immediate fall of the government, which is what all of us want on both sides of the argument.
So take it off and lift the embargo and down comes the regime. I mean, maybe. I'm sure you heard what you heard, Tom, and I appreciate your call. Ernesto Londoño, you're listening patiently here, and I wonder what you think about this dynamic that so much of the world already trades with Cuba, has no embargo with Cuba, and yet it hasn't exactly engendered the changes within Cuba that people assert would come following a lifting of the American embargo. What do you make of that, Ernesto?
It's interesting. I think certainly the countries in Latin America, you know, chiefly Colombia, Brazil, sort of the big economies that have started to engage more closely with Cuba, you know, could and should take a bolder stance in trying to bring about democratic reforms. You know, this is a region that has, by and large, a pretty proud tradition of democracy. And I think the region has been somewhat silent in its stance toward Cuba, and I think it could do more to speak up. You know, the European Union is in the midst of negotiating a cooperation agreement with Cuba, and it's unclear the scope of this, what it will look like. But the Europeans have been very clear. If this gets off the ground, you know, we're going to have to tackle some delicate issues. We're going to have to talk about human rights. We're going to have to talk about really meaningful economic reforms. And so far, the Europeans feel that the Cubans are negotiating in good faith and that they recognize that they can't attract the kind of foreign investment they want without making concessions, without really changing the way the system is run. Are they going to do so in a way that truly endangers their ability to stay in power? Probably not. But they're going to be confronted with some choices that I think will certainly change the status quo.
Do you see motion toward a change here, Ernesto? And if so, where would you first picture it occurring in U.S. policy?
I think there has been unmistakable shifts in public opinion. There was a recent poll by Florida International University that showed that a small majority of Cuban Americans in Miami, which is sort of ground zero for this debate, currently think the embargo is a bad policy. And there is a large majority of Cuban Americans that feel that restoring diplomatic relations would be a healthy step, would be good. So I think over time, the politicians who have made this a chief sort of political part of their brand are going to have to rethink their stance, because from an electoral standpoint, it is no longer going to bring them the kind of votes and the kind of turnouts that they've grown accustomed to. And they personally, you know, despite the way they feel in their hearts of hearts, I think they're going to have to pay attention to what their constituents think, what their constituents want, and what's going to keep them in office. So I think eventually we're bound to see a change.
An issue that is new again, more than half a century after embargo step sanctions were first implemented against Cuba in the United States. What an interesting moment here. I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. Ernesto Londoño at the New York Times editorial board. Ernesto, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Jorge Benitez at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council in Washington. Jorge Benitez, thank you for your time and thoughts today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
And Rick Herrero with Cuba Now, joining us from the studios of WLRN in Miami. Great to have you, Rick. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for all your comments online. Very interesting and on air. You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.